Top 100 Project
and action.
Hi there, listeners. The Top 100 Project is here to take a look back at the movies on the American Film Institute's 1998 and 2007 Top 100 lists. If you've never seen A Place in the Sun and you don't want to ruin for you, go away, because we're going to discuss this picture from start to finish. I'm Ryan Ellis with my delightful wife, Bev.
Hi.
Just a bit of a warning off the top. We're still a little bit sick, so our voices might be a little bit croaky.
Yeah.
Much better than during All About Eve,
mm-hmm.
but we're still not 100%.
We're on the mend, but yeah.
So the coming attractions trivia question for A Place in the Sun. Of the five films from the 1950s that were on the 1998 list, but not the 2007 list, A Place in the Sun had the shortest way to fall, from 92nd to nada. What had the longest drop for a 1950s picture that didn't make the 2007 cut?
I have to guess, so I'll say Giant.
Giant was also a George Stevens picture.
Yeah.
But no, it was a Montgomery Clift film, his other one on the list, From Here to Eternity, which went from 52nd to not being on the second list. So of all the 50s films, it had the longest drop. And we had one of our loyal listeners who got it already on the website.
That's right.
He guessed the day after we posted All About Eve.
So kudos, Grant.
Yeah, good way to go, Grant. Loyal listener. Gets it right. The Top 100 Project's 39th film, A Place in the Sun, was, as we said, 92nd on AFI's 1998 Top 100 list, right between My Fair Lady and The Apartment, but as we also said, was kicked off the team in 2007, although it was among the 400 nominees. A Place in the Sun premiered on August 15, 1951, then Paramount showed it to everybody a few weeks later on August 28th. Success! People like seeing Montgomery Clift pine for Elizabeth Taylor, and their on-screen romance made the movie some nice bucks. Bev will give us the skinny.
Montgomery Clift plays George Eastman, an estranged nephew of his rich uncle, who gives him an entry-level job on an assembly line. George becomes romantically involved with a plain co-worker named Alice, played by Shelley Winters. George also falls hard for the Eastman's glamorous family friend Angela, played by Elizabeth Taylor. George agonizes about his responsibilities to Alice while desperately wanting to be a part of Angela's world.
Or in a nutshell, fraternization equals death.
That pretty much sums it up right there.
Talk about a spoiler.
This movie's like a really long, really dramatic after-school special about the dangers of premarital sex.
That opens it up right there. You didn't like it, did you?
No, I didn't hate it or anything, but as somebody needs to defend its presence on this list, there's no way that this is one of the 100 best films ever made on anybody's estimation. It was nothing more than mediocre.
This is the first film since, I'm going to guess, Sullivan's Travels, which was a 10 years ago film, 1951, 1941, that you think doesn't belong at all and you didn't even like.
I really didn't like it. I wouldn't watch this movie again. I wouldn't recommend this movie.
When did you tune out? Was it earlier or was it later on?
That's a good question. I think I really gave it a shot initially and I was expecting to go somewhere. I'm not saying it didn't go somewhere, but when it all was done and the payoff wasn't there for me, I was pretty let down. So I wouldn't say it lost me at any point, but it was more like when everything was said and done, I was pretty disappointed with the overall result.
And it maybe never really had you in the first place. It's a melodrama.
No, no.
And as you said, as soon as it was over, I looked at you and said, what'd you think? And well, I'm not a melodrama fan, I believe is how you put it.
And I'm not. Never do I love a melodrama. It's like a rare melodrama where I enjoyed. I liked Gone with the Wind. That's probably the one exception, even though I still had complaints about that film.
At least this one's only half as long.
Yeah. But it still didn't get me. I still would rather watch Gone with the Wind, sit down and watch that, than watch Place in the Sun again.
Does it surprise you, then, that I bought this DVD and it is on our shelf?
Well, I'm leaving it up to you to defend this movie for me.
When I took it upstairs after it was over with, and I got thinking as I walked up the stairs, I don't dislike it the way that I know you did, but why did I buy it? I think the reason why I bought it was because I tried to own all the AFI movies way back when. If Birth of a Nation had been available, and I don't, if it was, it was a terrible print. I might have even bought that.
Mm-hmm.
This is quite a while ago now. We're talking
just for the sake of having a
early
library.
2000s. Yeah, when I started really buying DVDs by the truckload, it gets to the point where it's like, are you going to buy a special edition of something yet again? Or are you going to buy something that you don't already have that you maybe don't want that much? But here was the AFI list. Like we said in the intro many months ago, this is one of the reasons why I'm a film fan, this AFI list in 1998 and the list they've released since.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to have the record of those movies. This was on the original one. If it had not been on the original, I might have not bothered.
In a way, like, you know, tastes change over the years, and many times you go back and revisit a film that you didn't necessarily like and didn't see the value in when you were younger, but you really get it when you're older, or for whatever reason, it just resonates with you more. And when you own a movie, you're going to be way more inclined to go back and revisit it than if you just never buy it and you forget about it. So, you know, you trust the American Film Institute to pick movies that are worth watching enough times that you might get it. And who knows, maybe I'll eat these words decades from now, but I would be surprised.
Without prejudging a movie I've not seen since 1998 in American in Paris, there are very few now for a while, and there have been very few, like I just said, for a long time, that I at least will not like. I may not think they're brilliant and AFI worthy necessarily, but mm-hmm. the '50s is filled with really good films. The '40s was almost entirely great films, as we said when we ended with The Third Man, when we ended that decade. But this is definitely one of the weaker ones. And it's not like it's a bad picture. It just doesn't stand up to what we just saw, Sunset Boulevard, All About Eve. We're going to have fun with Singing in the Rain. We're going to have big epics that we haven't had in a while that are really good, like Bridge on the River Kwai, even Ben-Hur, which is enormous, but it's a pretty important film. And this one just doesn't really measure up. And it's not that the acting isn't good enough. I assume you like the actors. Monty Clift, great actor.
I'll say this about the acting. Like, I can't say that the performances were bad. I will say that Montgomery Clift, for all the hype, he looks like he's gonna hurt himself. He's just acting so hard. Like, he just looks so fraught and, like, upset that he's gonna burst a blood vessel or something. And he's supposed to be one of the first method actors, isn't that right?
Well, yes. This is the first movie we've had now that we can talk about the method.
Yes.
Because we're going to get into that next week, big time, with Streetcar Named Desire.
Yeah.
Brando and everyone in that movie, really, of the main stars, Malden, Carl Malden, and Kim Hunter, I believe, too. But mostly Brando. Were known as the method people. Their director, Leah Kazan, was a big part of that studio, too. But Cliff pushed against that idea because he didn't agree that he was a method actor, because he thought they were just doing variations of themselves. Brando and Dean and even Paul Newman, I guess, and all the rest of those guys and girls were just doing themselves, which is maybe what made them so good. But Cliff thought, I got to play a character, not just playing myself. So he didn't really truly associate with them. But okay, forget about what he thinks about himself. Is he a method actor? I would say probably he was, but he also was a pretty famously tortured soul.
Yeah.
Because he was a bisexual who didn't seem to be able to accept that. And then, as people probably know about him, he got into a really bad car accident. He almost died. And his friend from this movie, Elizabeth Taylor, who was 19 when they made it. Mm-hmm. They became friends on this. They were apparently never romantically involved. They made, I believe it was 3 movies together. And they remained friends until he died.
Well, whatever virtues the method may have added to his acting or not added to his acting, you know, I thought about this because I was trying to put my finger on what it was about this movie that just never captured me and never engaged me with the story. And there's the obvious thing that George is this kind of ambiguous, is he good, is he bad? The audience is supposed to empathize with him, even though he kind of does a pretty terrible thing. But his character's moral and ethics shouldn't matter. Like, I was thinking about Treasure of the Sierra Madre, where Dobbs is an incredible character, and even though he's pretty much like a bastard right through and through.
So is Harry Lime and The Third Man.
Right, but you still kind of, you know, have fun watching them, and you even root for them a little bit more than I found myself rooting for George. I did not care what became of him. I didn't care what became of Alice. And, you know, I just got the impression the whole movie that whatever happened to Angela now would bounce right off her and her kind of perfect middle class life of a pretty person.
I get the feeling that there's a good chance that had this not happened with Alice, that she might have grown tired of George anyway.
Yes.
And married somebody rich and maybe more popular, more famous, more powerful.
Yeah.
And maybe her father would have pushed her that way, whether she wanted to or not anyway.
Yeah.
So here's this great dream he has. And there's the very unsubtle comparison, incidentally, between the two. Alice is the life of drudgery, the plain girl. And Angela's the glamorous one, the one you have fun with.
Mm-hmm.
But who is better for George to be with? Very debatable.
Like, I can't stand up for Alice. She's not a very likable character. That's probably part of the problem. She is miserable. She's a total downer.
She's a downer at the beginning, and then she becomes, and understandably so, she's pregnant with his child.
Yeah.
But she becomes nothing but an anchor on his ankle.
It's made worse by the fact, like, his predicament is that nobody would want to spend their life with this woman. It's not because she's poor. It's not because she's plain looking. It's not because of circumstances. It's because she just doesn't seem like she's very much fun at all.
Mm-hmm.
And whereas Angela is the complete opposite. She's vibrant. She's beautiful. She has all these friends. She affords George this life he would never have access to without her attentions to kind of open the door for him. But above that, she's just fun and lively. You can understand at least why he's so desperate to ditch Alice so that he can be with Angela. But rooting for him, that's another thing, and that's where the film really lost me.
This is yet another movie where the star kills one of his co-stars, or one of her co-stars.
Mm-hmm.
We've had so many of those lately.
Yeah.
The Third Man, Treasure of the Sierra Madre, an attempted murder, not a successful one. Sunset Boulevard, and now here again. I'm sure we have plenty as we go along on this project, undoubtedly. But this was unintentional murder, and it's filmed quite effectively, I guess. It's not the best part of the movie when they go on that lake and you see his inner turmoil on his face. Because mm-hmm. we know why he's so conflicted, but she doesn't know he wants to kill her, so she should be sitting there thinking, why does he look like he's so sweaty and so upset? We're just on a lake having a picnic and having a nice little time. Does he maybe want to kill me? Could that be what this is?
If that scene isn't a direct homage to Sunrise, then there's a lot of incredible similarities.
I had a hard time finding influence from A Place in the Sun, except for it's based on an American tragedy by Theodore Dreiser, which had been filmed in 1931, mm-hmm. so 20 years before. But yeah, influence from other movies on this one, Sunrise, great example of that.
Yeah, oh yeah. I made a joke when we were watching it that she should have brought her bulrushes.
That's right. You're right. She might have survived. I also look closely.
Classic film joke. Yeah. Courtesy of Beth.
One of our older podcasts, Sunrise, way back when. I also looked very closely to see if the oar hits her in the head when she goes in the water. Yeah. I didn't see it.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's the story, that she supposedly gets cracked in the head with the oar. And so that Raymond Burr can have his over the top, and then you smash the oar into her brain and killed her. He's never been thought of as the best part of this movie, Raymond Burr.
No.
We will see in Rear Window, he later played Perry Mason, very famously on TV.
No kidding.
Yeah, he did some movie roles, including Rear Window, but he was mostly known as the TV actor. But in this performance, he's got such a vendetta as the DA right from the very beginning.
That's such a trope, though, anyway. That's such a common thing you see all the time. DAs that just seem to have it up for the defendant. They never stood a chance against the DA. By the time we got to that part, I so did not care. I mean, the book is called American Tragedy. I knew he was going to lose his case.
So this is George Stevens. This is the director and the producer. We said that earlier on. His first movie since Swing Time, and 23 AFIers have been between that mm-hmm. one and this one. Won't be such a gap the next time because we're going to do Shane quite soon. We'll review that in March. And then Giant, which you mentioned off the top, mm-hmm. another George Stevens film, was fourth one that made the two lists combined. We get to that one by May.
Mm-hmm.
And Stevens is one of those weird ones when it comes to the AFI. He had three films the first time, and then two of them got knocked off, this one and Giant, mm-hmm. but then they added Swing Time, so we still had two at least, with Shane making it both times.
Swing Time.
I think you'll like Shane. Giant, well, we'll see.
Does George Stevens have, like, family that owns or operates the AFI somehow?
His son, George Stevens Jr., does the commentaries on his DVDs. I believe he's involved pretty heavily in the film community, so maybe he's
involved. Well, there you go, because maybe that explains why Swing Time and why this pile of mediocrity is on the list.
But I do think there's a great use in the movie by Stevens of pans, the long dissolves, the long takes he uses, the extreme close-ups at the right time. See, I think he directs the movie quite well, and he did win the Oscar. We'll talk about the awards at the end of this, but he did win the Oscar for direction. And with the screenplay he was given by Michael Wilson and Harry Brown, they adapted the Patrick Kearney play. And as we said before, it was based on the book by Theodore Dreiser. Michael Wilson, a bit of a sidebar before, but we'll get back to Stevens in a second, but Michael Wilson was blacklisted right after this movie.
Really?
In fact, yeah. He only got writing credit and his Oscar years later for his work on Bridge on the River Kwai. He wrote some really good movies. He also wrote Planet of the Apes, which did not make the list, but it's an extremely famous film and a very popular mm-hmm. one. And the epic AFI, Lawrence of Arabia, which we'll get to later this year. So he was a very talented writer.
But he was un-American?
He dared to be an un-American. He was blacklisted. But as far as Stevens goes, with the screenplay and material he had, I think he did a good job of finding the right shots and using the technical skills at his disposal. Maybe you don't agree, but I think that it was at least well-directed.
I think a well-directed film would have engaged the viewer more.
Well, and then maybe you knock my down my point.
I think
right
his
there.
I think that he probably has some well-crafted shots and some individual things that you can admire about the film, but as far as really capturing the audience, I just believe that it fails. I could be wrong. And for the record, I am vindicated by the fact that this film only has 73% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Is it all?
I know that's still a good score, but you look at most
not
of the films
compared
on the
to the
list.
Ones we've...
No. Like many, many 100%.
We haven't focused much on Rotten Tomatoes, the overall score, very often. At one of our podcasts we did And I mentioned, I think, four or five films, and they all had pretty good scores. The lowest one was 83%.
Yeah, yeah. Like, that's a dismal score.
10% less is quite...
Yeah, yeah. It's pretty bad.
To contrast to the recent Major League Baseball Hall of Fame elections, you have to get 75% to get into that. Well, with those reviews, Place and Time wouldn't make the Hall of Fame. I love making baseball references whenever I can.
I have no opinion on the Baseball Hall of Fame and their operations.
Well, Stevens and everybody, of course, shot this movie in 1949, and they delayed it. Paramount delayed it for a while, a good year, I guess it was, because Sunset Boulevard was going to come out. They didn't want to compete with it at the Oscars or at the box office.
Huh.
And yet, Place in the Sun did succeed even more than Sunset Boulevard did with the Oscars, and it did pretty well, as I said at the top, with the audience.
Yeah,
too.
Yeah, it was a hit. It was a big hit.
Stevens was a fine filmmaker. I mean, whether you've liked him or not, he's made some good films, but he was one of the many guys that went away during the war in the mid-40s.
That's right.
And that maybe cut into his best years, I suppose you could say, the best years of his life. As far as the themes and the best scenes go, and I thought George's first day on the film was kind of like The Tramp in modern times.
Yeah.
He couldn't quite keep up, except he also... obviously adapted pretty quickly.
He's also kind of a drifter, a wanderer. We first meet him, he's hitchhiking.
Reminded me a little bit of the Taxi Driver opening. Where is Travis coming from? He just walks into that cab office and acts like he came directly from the Vietnam War, and I want to be a cab driver. We don't know anything about him, really. And in a way, Eastman's the same. We hear that he was a bellhop in Chicago when the uncle saw him and said, come to me if you ever want to get a job.
Yeah, but he's pretty unmoored, and he has nowhere to go. I don't even remember if he has a place to spend the night.
Well, when he does have his apartment, there's the very unsubtle, but I thought kind of cheeky reference with the vicar's sign that's always flashing.
Yes.
We don't see his apartment much, but when we do,
that's right.
And we didn't say it off the top, Angela's last name is Vickers.
Yeah.
So it's constantly beating in the background of his brain.
It's there, but it's
I want to be with her. I want to be with her. I want to be with her. Okay, we get it.
It's also a reminder that her family's wealthy and that they're a presence in that town. They're powerful people.
And speaking of Angela, no matter what the novel uses for names, I'm not even sure what names they use. They may have changed them. But Angela and Alice. Angela, almost like Angel. Right? And then Alice, he calls her Al a few times, which masculinizer. Is that a word? He makes her masculine.
Yeah.
So there's that contrast, too. The movie does beat that a little bit.
Yeah, it's not subtle. Yeah, definitely the differences are there.
But speaking of the angel thing with Elizabeth Taylor, everyone wants to say, so many people at least want to say that she's the most beautiful woman in the history of the business. For me, she's not even close to the most beautiful woman. I mean, I think he's one of the best-looking guys. And they are a very attractive couple. But
I'm kind of with you on, obviously, she's a very beautiful woman. But this notion that she's the most beautiful woman that ever worked in Hollywood, I've never really... agreed with that necessarily.
Maybe
either. And Montgomery Clift is not for me either. I wasn't blown away by his handsomeness. And in that way, I guess I struggled to understand why Angela loves him so much and so quickly. Mm. And I guess it's
after ignoring him twice.
Yeah.
One of which is in the very opening scene. We see her drive by. No, she doesn't know who he is at that point.
Yeah.
But she drives right by him when he's hitchhiking on the road. And then this is mentioned in one of the AFI shows, the first AFI show at least. William Friedkin talks about it. The greatest moment I ever saw in a movie was when George sees Angela come into the house early on in A Place in the Sun. He turns around and his whole life is over because he sees this gorgeous woman. Now, I don't know why that would be his favorite moment in the history of any movie.
Yeah, that's...
But that's what he says.
He can do better.
But yeah, she ignores him then too.
Yeah, yeah.
Until she finally sees him playing pool. He makes a nice shot and, ooh, I kind of like this guy.
I know. I find that strange that she ignores him.
Which
so
is why I think, and you seem to agree, that she would very likely, or very possibly at least, toss him aside somewhere in the near future.
Yeah.
Had the Alice thing never happened.
I agree.
Yeah.
Yeah. She's young, and she's really just into him because he's quiet.
Yeah.
Like, everybody, when someone's quiet, I guess everybody assumes that they're a good person. They assume that there's a great depth underneath still waters. But was he really a good person?
Maybe not. He's not thinking about Alice. He's not outwardly or inwardly, from what we see of him, showing regret that this girl died.
If he did not have designs to murder her, if he didn't go
He shouldn't admit that he wanted to go through
the killer. No, but I say
stand.
If he didn't go through 9/10 of the motions that it would take to kill her, she wouldn't have been on that lake. She wouldn't have been there with him at all, in a place where she can't swim, where she's in danger. So he is absolutely responsible for her death, even if he had a last-minute change of heart.
The real culprit here is Labor Day. Had it not been Labor Day, they wouldn't have gone out in that lake in the first place. But just as the peace was closed.
I can think of one other culprit, and that is the sinful, sinful sin that they committed and were duly punished for. Premarital sex.
There's the subtext, sure, yeah.
Yep. Oh, subtext, hardly. It is text. It is right there.
People say horror movies, especially slasher movies, have based so much of their success on that. If you dare to have sex, you're going to die.
Yeah, well, this movie does certainly the same.
Both of them die.
It's kind of eye-rolling. It's probably another reason why I just couldn't get into this movie, is this notion that people should be punished so completely for the sin of two consenting adults having sex when they're not married. As morality tales go, it's just not really something that I think the modern world can get behind. And
too bad George didn't carry some handy condoms with him.
Yeah.
And that brings us to our sponsor for the week. Condoms. Use them. Well, speaking of Shelley Winters on that boat, one of the things that you may not know, if you've not seen The Poseidon Adventure,
I haven't.
She's in that, and she always, constantly, never stops bragging about how she's a great swimmer, an award-winning swimmer, even though she plays an overweight woman in that film,
yeah,
and gets a chance to show off her swimming talents. So it's a great little ironic difference 20 years later for that film to this one, 21 years in fact, that she can't swim, and that's why she dies. I don't know if that was a play on that from Poseidon Adventure to this one, but her inability to simply grasp the boat or something like that.
I know, the boat's right there. Even if you can't swim, you can dog paddle for a second.
But supposedly she got clonked on the head.
Well, that's right, the oar that never actually
hits her.
Yeah.
So here's a trivia question for you, Bev. What is the name of the lake where Alice drowns?
Oh, what is it? Loon Lake.
Loon Lake it is.
Yeah. God, how could I even have to think that hard
about
that?
Doesn't mean to, but Angela gives them the idea by talking about how somebody drowned there.
Yeah, they draw it out pretty clearly.
Wheels are turning.
I could drown my pregnant girlfriend. Yes, yes.
Yeah, the wheels are turning. Well, Shelley Winters, Miss Alice, this is her only AFIer. She had a 56-year career after starting in 1943. Mm-hmm. And she first had a slew of uncredited parts. Then was later in Night of the Hunter, after this, Lolita, The Poseidon Adventure I just mentioned, and she would win Oscars for Diary of Anne Frank, directed by Stevens, and A Patch of Blue when she became a brassy supporting type player. But a big name in the business and worked a long time was on Roseanne, the TV show. Many
was she really?
Yeah, I think she was the grandmother, was she not? Wasn't it Estelle Parsons from Bonnie and Clyde was the mother, and then Shelley Winters was the grandmother, I believe.
Oh, how about
I don't
that?
Know much about Roseanne.
It's
I think
been
I have
years
that right.
Since I saw
so. And getting back to Taylor for a few minutes, this is our first of three AFIers with Giant and Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf still coming. So glad that movie's on the list, because that is one of my favorites from the 60s.
Yeah, that is one of my favorites, too. I always loved Edward Albee. Yep. Definitely love that film.
But here's the curious connection for Taylor. Her two AFIers in the 98 list, Place in the Sun, Giant, both didn't make the 2007 list. But Virginia Woolf made the 2007 list after not making the 98 list.
Sometimes it's like they talk to each other and decide things collectively like... You know, we really want to get Taylor on the list, but...
Well, they got it right, because of those three movies, that's definitely the best one.
Yeah, I agree.
It also gets Burton on there, and I don't believe he was on the first list
there
at
you
all.
Go.
Richard Burton was a great actor, and as we all know, those two were long-time stormy, married, not married, married people. As far as the supporting cast goes, we talked a little about Raymond Burr, so two other people I want to mention. Fred Clark, he plays George's lawyer, Bellows, and he was the studio exec Sheldrake in Sunset Boulevard.
Oh, how about
I remember that?
That
name Sheldrake because it will be used in The Apartment. Apparently, Billy Wilder loved that last name for a character. And the last one I want to mention, he's not a big part of the movie, but he does have a kind of important role, I suppose. It's Ian Wolfe who plays Alice's potential abortion doctor.
Yes.
And the reason why I mention him is because he was in some memorable movies, including Rebel Without a Cause, which we'll do in a few weeks. But he, to me, will always be Hirsch from WKRP.
Okay, well, you're on your own.
Another
there.
TV reference on this podcast.
You and our brother-in-law, you guys with your WKRP.
It was a great TV show.
Yes, yes, I'm sure it was.
I'm going to dress something useful out of this podcast.
Little before my time, old man, that's all.
The other supporting character from this movie, I guess you're going to mention, is Anne Revere, who plays George's mother. And here's a trivia question for you. Where does she live?
Oh, where was it? Pennsylvania?
No, further west.
Oh, where?
Kansas City, Missouri.
Oh, gosh. I got it totally wrong.
Go Missouri. You get the feeling that she hasn't seen her, I guess it's supposed to be her brother, or at least her brother-in-law, the uncle, in a long time.
Yeah.
And there's no connection with them whatsoever.
They have the same last name, so I guess it would be her brother-in-law, because they're both Eastmans.
Right.
Yeah, you get the impression that he had a pretty unconventional childhood as well, that he left something behind that he really had to run away from.
Well, she's religious, right? So maybe
Not just religious, there's that one scene, a good scene in my estimation, I can pay a compliment to this movie, when he sees the, not carolers, but the churchy folks, what would you call them? He sees the missionaries singing on the sidewalk, and he stops and he looks at them, and you can see this moment of pensiveness, And you know it's because he spent his own childhood doing something just like that. But he left. He ran away from that life. So there's something sinister about that. Or, yeah, either it's his desire for the American dream, or maybe there was something that he was running away from.
Yeah. Well, you know, the one thing about George that makes him a bit of a hero, at least in the Republicans' eyes, he was thinning the middle class herd by killing Alice.
There you go. Picking himself up by his bootstraps, solving his own problems. Right. You know, he didn't want to create a welfare baby. No.
Of course not.
The other extra sinister thing about him wanting to kill Alice is he was also killing his own unborn child.
It is. Like, there's no dispute it's his kid,
too. Yeah, yeah. Like, it's really bad. It really makes it hard to sympathize with him as a character.
On the other hand, though, Alice worked on an assembly line, so maybe death wasn't so bad after all.
Death is preferable to boxing bikinis.
Yeah, it's a pretty lousy job. Well, George had already been promoted out of it, as it was. He was moving up in the business. Forget Angela. He might have done well in the business, regardless of her.
If he had only had condoms.
If he'd only used condoms. All right, a few more technical notes, and then we'll get out of here. The costumes, which won an Oscar, Edith Head, we've mentioned already before. She starred in the mid-20s and worked until 1982. What a long, storied career.
Edith Head, for people who don't know who she is, she was homaged in The Incredibles. There is a character that
No capes.
Yes. Directly based on
Edith Head. The costume designer for this. Superheroes, yeah, that's right.
Pretty beloved Hollywood figure, Edith Head.
She did so many movies. I didn't even count, but it's dozens and dozens. She also did costumes for AFI's, Sullivan's Travels, Double Indemnity, Sunset Boulevard, All About Eve, Rear Window, and Vertigo. I may have even missed some. There's such a long list of movies that she worked on. The cinematographer, another Oscar winner, William C. Mellor, M-E-L-L-O-R. And I liked his use of deep focus. We've been seeing that a lot since Citizen Kane, and I think he did a pretty good job lighting this film. A black and white film yet again. We're going to get color soon, but we're still doing black and white films, and we have ever since Fantasia, way back when. And the editor, William Hornbeck, also won an Oscar, and he also edited It's a Wonderful Life and Stevens' other AFI films, Giant and Shame.
How long was it?
Just about 2 hours.
There you go. It's about
probably
2 hours.
Too long, actually, but that's the story more than the editing.
I guess so. It has a slow pace, so you can excuse the time because the pacing is slow. It's not like, you know, winning an Oscar for editing Gone with the Wind, where it seems as though they didn't cut anything out, so I'm not really sure how they can get an Oscar for that.
Yeah. All right, so the awards and other AFI lists. There's 6 Academy Awards this film took home. We've mentioned, I think, all of them by now. Director for Stevens, screenplay for Wilson and Brown, cinematography, editing, costume design, and the music score, which actually we didn't mention that one. That was Franz Waxman. Mm-hmm. He did the music on Sunset Boulevard the year before this. It was also nominated for Best Picture and Best Actor for Clift and Actress for Shelley Winters. I think she's more of a supporting player, but they put her in the main category. Taylor was not recognized. And a bit of a sidebar on this, the 2014 Golden Globes were held just last weekend. Place in the Sun won the first ever Golden Globe for Best Motion Picture Drama.
That's right. That's what I saw that.
Beat out next week's top 100 film, A Streetcar Named Desire.
I think history would probably revise that if they could.
Well, even in the original list, Streetcar was, I believe, 44 or something. And Place in the Sun was almost 50 points lower. Place in the Sun's 2 other recognitions, it was on the National Film Registry in 1991, and 53rd on the top 100 Passions. And whether or not you like the film, you have to admit it's pretty passionate.
If you insist.
Okay, one more thing I want to mention before we leave here. Angela shows up at the end on death row, which maybe was something they did back in 1951. I don't think they do that now. I wondered if that maybe was kind of like an imagination for him. Or maybe it was just a studio saying, we got to get this big star back in the movie. She hasn't been in a long time. And let's have her show up on death row to torture this poor guy.
Yeah, I mean, they let her right in the cell to give him a hug and say goodbye.
Which seems like that's not something they would do. Maybe
it also seems unlikely that her family, that her father, would let her go anywhere near this guy after everything.
Because the father didn't like him that much before he knew
that he was he had to be convinced to begin with. And then all this comes out. You can imagine her family would just want to keep her as far as possible from this guy, even though he's obviously doomed. It's irrelevant. Yeah. It did seem really unlikely.
It's painted very naturalistically. I'm not saying it is actually a ghostly fantasy, but it may have just been what I said, that the studio said, we gotta get Taylor back in there. She's a big star. Find some way to get her back in the movie.
Yeah, curious to know if that part was in the book or not.
And the only time that we really see her otherwise at the end of the movie is when he's visualizing her as he's walking off to the gallows. Well, the death chamber, what do they have? The lethal injection, whatever it is they're going to use to kill him. Yeah, and hey, this movie does what Double Indemnity didn't do. Shows a man going off to be killed by the state.
But you just said it again. He's thinking of Angela. He's not thinking of Alice.
And he never wants to.
He never really has proper remorse for his crime except for how it's affected his own life. Yeah. He's not really a very likable character. Maybe that's part of the critique on the American dream, that he leaves his mother, he goes and tries to achieve that, to enter that world, to not just get Angela to help him achieve that, but also to have that dream girl, to have that dream job, to have all those things. Maybe that implies an implicit selfishness.
But played by a good actor, whether or not you thought he was good, I thought he was a great actor.
I thought he was good. Listen, I thought it was a good film.
He makes the character
sympathetic.
I didn't
think it was a great film.
Okay.
But I don't know. I disagree that he makes it sympathetic, though.
Okay. Well, as sympathetic as it probably can be. And by the way, even though I acknowledge that we own this film and I bought it a long time ago, if I were voting on either one of the lists, there's no way this would have made the top 100. No.
It's not a terrible film by any means, but it just really doesn't deserve that kind of praise and the esteem of being named one of the 100 best American films ever.
Well, how about next week's film, which I don't know if you've seen.
Streetcar. I don't know how. I was a theater major in high school. I went to School of the Arts. I never read the play. I read other Tennessee Williams plays. I don't actually even really know what happens. I have some vague idea of just from what you see and, you know, The Simpsons and other various culture.
I think we'll mention The Simpsons next week because... Yeah. That is the next one on the Top 100 Project. The first of four opportunities to discuss the most talented movie star who ever lived, in my opinion, Marlon Brando. And Eli Kazan's A Streetcar Named Desiree. So the coming attractions trivia question for A Streetcar Named Desire. Marlon Brando, Carl Malden, and Kim Hunter played the same roles in the film that they played on stage. Vivian Leigh was the newcomer in the main cast. Whom did she replace when the play became a film?
All right, so for the answer to that question, tune in next week for our Streetcar Named Desire podcast. If you'd like more trivia, please go to our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes. You can find us on Podomatic, top100project.podomatic.com. What did you think of A Place in the Sun? Did you like it? Would you like to dispute my estimation of the film?
Please. She didn't like it.
Please send us an email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. We'd love to hear what you thought. And